Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Hank.
Where are we off to today?
Well, you know, it's funny. There has been this real sense of heaviness that continues, not just in my own heart, but in my students' hearts and in my friends' hearts, and I can see it in your face.
It's just too much going on.
Too much going on. I mean, there's just like we're all dragging, and I talked about it last week, my conversation with my vet, and how before we could even talk about my cat, he needed to talk about how he was feeling. And when I went to class, you know, yesterday, now with the fires that are going on, I had students who were in tears because they'd lost their family home, and, you know, students that are still grappling with the impact of the shootings in Las Vegas. I mean, it's so much, Hank. It's so much that I had to stop down class again yesterday and just break the kids up into teams and let them talk. So we stay with that kind of theme of this heaviness in our heart that we're all feeling. And I know you were off last week and on a joyful vacation up to San Francisco, but were you able to feel the joy, or were you still kind of dragging that sense with you?
Well, we got there on Saturday, which is before the shooting, so we had a very good Saturday and Sunday, and then the news about Las Vegas hit, and that brought us down, but we still managed to have a good time.
I'm glad you did, because that's kind of the takeaway from all of this, is that in these moments of deep grief and heaviness and weightedness and the feeling that we can't catch our breath, right, that we feel like the waves are coming so fast that we keep getting pummeled, that we have to find those moments where we can come up for air and take in the sunshine and feel the warmth and kind of settle ourselves, because another wave is going to come. So there is that art in caring for ourselves to be able to come up, take a breath, notice what's around us that's still beautiful, hug the person next to us, and then be ready to go down again and hold it together until the next opportunity to come up for air. But I'm glad to have you back, and I'm glad that you had a good trip.
Yep, I'm ready to go back.
I know. Well, it just like the waves of despair come over us more quickly, sometimes the distance between vacations or moments of joy tend to seem like they're getting spread out further and further. But we'll try to find those nice moments just within our day-to-day. And for today's show, it's World Mental Health Day. You know, and just the sound of it, World Mental Health Day would sound like something we're celebrating, that we'd send up balloons, and it would be a fabulous thing to recognize all of the good work being done in the mental health field. But that's not really the theme of Mental Health Day. World Mental Health Day is always recognized on October 10th. The objective is to raise awareness of mental health issues and to mobilize efforts to support mental health. And it's also an opportunity for all of those who are working in the mental health field and on mental health issues to talk about their work and discuss what needs to be done to make mental health care available and a reality for people worldwide. So that's the goal of World Mental Health Day. And that terrifies me. That whole two paragraphs make me incredibly uncomfortable, because we don't know enough about how to care for people's mental health and well-being to want to make mental health care and interventions a reality for people worldwide. In some ways, and this is the most probably cynical part of me, this idea that we're going to spread our Western ideas of mental health out into the world are like spreading McDonald's out into the world as if it's a great thing that we've all discovered. And we don't know enough. And it all kind of came to light for me in class yesterday, or after class yesterday. I was walking through campus and a student came and found me and wanted to talk. And she said, you know, I just need to tell you that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, my grandmother was diagnosed with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. I'm not sure which one. And then the same clinician went on and diagnosed my mother with something and put her on medications. And they in turn decided I must have the predisposition for it as well and put me on a medication. And for 2 years, I took this drug that I don't know why I was taking it. And I finally had to go off because I couldn't function. And now I feel like I've lost parts of my memory and my functioning, and I just feel out of sorts. And my heart, you know, the heaviness was already there. At that point, it sank even further into my belly. And I just, all I could do was hug her and say, I'm sorry. And I apologize for the poor interventions and treatment that you received. And I hope that you're finding support in other ways. And I realized the reason the idea of a World Mental Health Day terrifies me is because it's backward in its existence, just like Columbus Day was backwards in its existence, right? We had Columbus Day for the last 100 or so years celebrating the discovery of America and how, you know, apparently now things were wonderful because Columbus brought, you know, the United States into being, not recognizing that really what Columbus Day was the moment that indigenous people's lives were disrupted and ravaged and they were exploited and their way of life destroyed. And I had this moment of clarity thinking World Mental Health Day is a bit like Columbus Day, that we're celebrating what we think is the mental health opportunities for treatment for people all over the world. But in reality, what we're doing quite often in the mental health field is ravaging and disrupting and exploiting people's lives in ways that we don't know how to fix. So we're going to talk about mental health, which we do each week, but from the perspective of what we are doing right and what we need to do better and what we're doing completely wrong. Because as we talk about each week, nothing is all good or all bad. There are good things being done in the world of mental health care, but we have to find them and pay attention to them and really know what they are, just as we need to pay attention to all the ways that things are not going right in the world of mental health care and be able to identify them and rectify them and move forward. So I'm going to try to bring some balance to that conversation. But because it's an opportunity for those working in the mental health field, today is a day for those who do the work of mental health professionals to discuss their work and what they see is the direction of our profession and what needs to happen. And so I have a guest in the studio with me today, Coraline Robinson, who's going to kind of bring some balance or just some discourse, this conversation, but we'll also be opening up the phones to anyone else who wants to join in on this conversation. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of our conversation at 781-3875. You can find me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org under the News Talk tab. All of our shows are there. Bree keeps them updated. You can go back for the last 4 or 5 years. And then you can podcast our show. If you'd like to go to Apple Podcasts, search A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and subscribe, and the shows will show up on your device whenever you're ready to listen to them. So as always, I'm looking forward to having this conversation. I'm happy you're here joining us today, and we'll take a breath, get centered, and we'll come back to start our conversation with Coraline. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and we're here today talking about World Mental Health Day, which is observed every year on October 10th, and whether or not we really are moving in the right direction. Should we be promoting mental health as it stands, mental health interventions, mental health treatment, mental health care as it stands. Because the main struggle we have is that we don't have a real lock solid definition of what mental illness is or what a mental disorder is. It fluctuates with the social context or what's happening in society. We have things that shift and morph our understanding of the brain and how it works or how interpersonal relationships work. It's not a science in terms that we can take a blood test or do a brain scan and determine unequivocally that this is a mental health issue. And the concern is that for the amount of people that are being treated and feel they're getting healing or better, there are untold millions of people, at least half as many people, if not more, who not only aren't getting treatment or relief when they go in to seek mental health services, but they're actually getting worse, that they're actually going down a rabbit hole where they thought they were suffering when they went in for help, mm-hmm. and then it just got 10 times worse, mm-hmm. and finding their way out. So it's really difficult to promote a profession that is still grappling with how it sees itself in the world. So I brought in a guest today, Coraline Robinson. We've been friends for a few years now.
Yes.
She's a fellow LMFT, and she's been working in the mental health field with various agencies. We've known each mm-hmm. other from different mm-hmm. agencies in the community since 2004. Mm-hmm. And now you're currently working as program director at Balanced Treatment Programs, which if people aren't aware, it's a clinic, a local clinic that started about a year ago that's working with a variety of mental health and addictive disorders mm-hmm. Or imbalances. Mm-hmm. And so, Coraline, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for including me. This is a very important conversation. Yeah.
So I just want to start off by reading the definition of mental disorder mm-hmm. from the current DSM-5. And for those who aren't aware, the DSM-5, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, is our Bible of the mental health profession. It is how we speak the same language of what people are suffering with. And it's mm-hmm. a book that's grown from very few disorders. I wish I had the number in my head because I don't know. From the very first issue in 1952 to the DSM-5, which now has like 300 different ways that people can mm-hmm. be suffering. And a couple things around the DSM-5. One is that Dr. Alan Francis, who mm-hmm. was the lead writer of the DSM-4th version, mm-hmm. has spent the last few years since the DSM-5 was released writing a book, going on air, writing articles, going to conventions, saying that this DSM-5 is a dangerous revamp of what's been happening. And he says not only is it increasing the amount of people that are going to be ineffectively diagnosed and treated for things that should not be treated. Mm-hmm. He said, Dr. Alan Francis said, I still have regrets about the mistakes we made in the DSM-4, one of which being the broadening of the diagnosis of autism, ADHD, and bipolar disorder, mm-hmm. which he believes led to skyrocketing epidemic levels of diagnosis for these disorders that should never have been diagnosed. Mm-hmm. He said, so not only did we not correct the mistakes of the DSM-4, we continue to make more mistakes by expanding the amount of diagnosis we make in the DSM-5. Mm-hmm. And so having said that, I decided to look at the definition of of what a mental disorder is according to the DSM-5, the latest definition. And the reason this is important is that unlike the definition of food or water that is in the Merriam Dictionary and doesn't change with every mm-hmm. alliteration of the Merriam Dictionary, every time we rewrite the DSM, the definition of a mental disorder changes. Mm-hmm. And it might be good news if we're getting better at narrowing down what actually are struggles and are normal life struggles. Mm-hmm. But it's concerning if you're someone who is diagnosed with a mental disorder in previous definitions of the DSM, either 2, 3, or 4, mm-hmm. and have been being treated for something that turns out to not have been a disorder at all, but changed your life. Mm-hmm. Most obvious, the most common one discussed is that, you know, in 1973, the mental disorder of being homosexual mm-hmm. was finally removed.
Yeah.
So here's the current, mm-hmm. and then I'm going to get your thoughts on this. A mental disorder is a syndrome characterized by clinically significant disturbance in an individual's cognition, emotion regulation, or behavior that reflects a dysfunction in the psychological, biological, or developmental processes underlying mental functioning. Mental disorders are usually associated with significant distress. So that would mean so significant that you're hearing voices or can't get out of bed mm-hmm. or feed yourself or get up. Would mm-hmm. you agree?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, depends on, you got to look at the different areas. So there can be distress where someone isn't able to hold a job or right. go to work.
That would be significant. Mm-hmm. The daily functioning has stopped.
Yeah.
But the definition goes on. And this is the part I think that we fail to recognize mm-hmm. in our practice. It goes on to say that an acceptable or culturally approved response to a common stressor or loss, such as the death of a loved one, is not a mm-hmm. mental disorder. Mm-hmm. Socially deviant behavior, such as political activism, religious beliefs, or sexual behaviors, mm-hmm. and conflicts that are primarily between the individual and society are not mental disorders. Mm-hmm. That should be the first thing that is written in the definition, because that would probably cover 90% of the things that people struggle with in their mm-hmm. daily life. Mm-hmm. So you heard my introduction about World Mental Health Day, and you work in the field every day. Where do you see the profession mm-hmm. at this time?
You know, I kind of see, I wish I could, I don't know, maybe I'll live another 50 years, but I feel like we're at a sea change right now. I feel like in the 60s and 70s with the pharmaceutical industry, there was a big change, and there was the introduction of medication for mental health imbalances. So that was a huge sea change. And now we have fully embraced that. That is here, and it's been here for decades. And I feel like now the profession is looking at, okay, what's good with that and what's bad with that? And that's great. I think that we're at a point where we're asking the right questions. Like we, as professionals in mental health, we're very privileged in that we're educated that we have to be self-aware. To do therapy, there's all sorts of personal therapy and training. You have to be self-aware. In being self-aware, you start asking questions and you have self-doubt, which is actually, as long as it's not extreme self-doubt, which is a healthy thing. And I think the profession is starting to doubt itself, which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's bringing up questions that are going to actually, in the long run, protect people. Is medication, you know, the only solution? Do we need to be careful about diagnosis? Is it subjective? Is it temporary? Is it permanent? All those questions we need to ask ourselves, because we are responsible for this work and for, you know, clients getting better as well as ourselves. So I feel like we're at a really pivotal time, and it's exciting. It's also scary, because when you start doubting and asking questions, you see the bad as well as the good. So I do think that these kind of conversations that are happening now publicly are going to be in the best interest of the population. It's just going to take some time.
And I guess that's what concerns me, because the first time the American Psychiatric Association at a convention said, we are heading in the wrong direction, we're over-prescribing and over-diagnosing, was 5 years ago now. Mm-hmm. So in those 5 years, how many people, the young lady I talked to yesterday being an example of that, mm-hmm. have been medicated for something that did not exist and now will pay the price for that for however long the ongoing symptoms mm-hmm. of the medication last. It's like, it's hard for me to be as hopeful as you, because I just keep thinking of the millions of people who are trusting a profession that has tried to align itself with the medical profession. And the medical profession itself is not exact science. There's a lot of guessing that goes mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. But by its own definition, you know, our profession, our whole way of diagnosing is not a scientific way of diagnosing. Mm-hmm. It's called descriptive system mm-hmm. of diagnosing. Mm-hmm. So we have a person who comes in and self-reports mm-hmm. symptoms from their perspective, and if they have a certain number of the symptoms that align with the diagnosis and they've had it for a prescribed period of time, then that indicates a diagnosis that then goes into their medical record that stays with them for mm-hmm. as long as they have a medical record. And you said, you know, earlier, are these diagnoses short-term or permanent? Mm-hmm. I've never met someone who got a diagnosis of depression or anxiety or bipolar who was told, but you'll get over it and mm-hmm. be fine.
One of the first things we tell our clients at Balance, because we feel like our job is not just addressing the disorder imbalance, but empowering the client to be their own advocate in the system. So one of the first things I tell them is, understand is a diagnosis is subjective and it can be temporary. So what I might diagnose you with might be different than a previous diagnosis, and that's okay. Because again, this is subjective, and I tell them there is no blood test for this. So please understand the way things are talked about scientifically, that's a language, they have to simplify, they have to compartmentalize. But the truth is it's much more complicated than that. There's a lot of shared responsibility, and that's, yeah, one of the first things is a diagnosis is absolutely subjective and it can be temporary.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. My guest is Corleen Robinson, and we're talking about World Mental Health Day, and are we in a place where we should be trying to increase the level of mental health care that's available to people worldwide when we're still not sure that the care we're giving to people at this moment is in their best interest? And you're invited to be part of the conversation. Our number is 805-781-3875. And remember, part of World Mental Health Day is an opportunity for all of us who are working in the mental health field to talk about your work and what needs to be done to increase mental health care, to improve mental health care. So especially if you're in the mental health field, we'd love to hear from you today. And what's your take on the direction or the quality of care you're able to offer today? And do you feel we're serving people in their best interest? 805-781-3875. So, Corleen, talk a bit about Balance Treatment Center, because I'm assuming most people have no idea where you are and what you do.
Yeah, Balance, it's actually Balance Treatment Programs, and we have several programs. So the one in San Luis Obispo has been here just over a year, but down in Calabasas and Malibu, they've been there for about 4 or 5 years. So there's a residential program for adults in Malibu, and that's for higher need, people that need some monitoring, that have some safety issues still. And then the programs in Calabasas and San Luis Obispo are outpatient. So it's a clinic where you get 9 to 15 hours of primarily group work a week, but you do go home. You're not there more than 3 or 4 hours at a time. So there needs to be some measure of safety and independence, because it's not any sort of closed facility.
So you're returning home.
Right. And actually, all of our programs they're not facilities. They're not locked. One is a beautiful home, and the others are clinics. So these are voluntary programs where people come and go. And really, I think what is different at Balance is the idea that we look at people in terms of what's out of balance in their life, and we look at all aspects of their life, including society and culture, because that has an influence on people. And a lot of times individuals do not see the responsibility of culture and society on them. They just look at their responsibility or maybe their family's responsibility, and it goes beyond that. Often it's much more complicated than that.
And so what kind of disorders or disturbances do you see and treat?
We see everything from social anxiety, people who are maintaining their baseline functioning by using cannabis or alcohol to remain, you know, socially acceptable or functional. We also see people with schizoaffective and schizophrenia. That's been their diagnosis. That doesn't mean they're permanently going to be schizophrenic. It means that at this point in time, they're responding to something with hallucinations and delusions. So we work with that as well, the whole range.
And then the addictive side, the addiction side, do you have people who are, you know, currently struggling with alcohol and
Absolutely.
Opioid addictions?
Yes. Yes, we need to have to accept a client. They need to have a primary mental health diagnosis. But for most people in the profession, we understand that if you have a drug and alcohol addiction, you likely have a mental health problem. So if they need detox or medical care, we're not the right place. We don't have that on staff. But if they're stable enough physically and they can start addressing the underlying conflicts or sources of that behavior, then we're happy to help them.
And so you talk about 9 to 15 sessions, mostly group. And I think a lot of people you know, are concerned about group because of privacy or having to listen to other people's problems. Mm-hmm, you know, a lot of people, that's a turnoff for them. So talk a bit about why you feel that group work can be really powerful or beneficial.
Yeah. The groups are small. So we're not, the groups are usually 6 to 8 people. So they're pretty intimate groups. And I think it's very powerful. My experience is that it has a different type of power than individual work, because the group really is able to break down stereotypes, debunk assumptions. People sit in front of others that look very different, that are of different age, of different sexual orientation, and they're able to find common ground, to find common suffering. And in that, they don't feel as odd or they don't feel as diseased. They realized, okay, this suffering is normal on some level. I need help, but it's a response to things that are not normal. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really powerful. Obviously, clients know therapists are paid. But when they're in a group and they get support from a peer, that peer's not paid. That peer is genuinely reaching out. Mm-hmm. And it's a very reciprocal type of healing.
And so from your perspective, because this is something that I grapple with all the time and get asked about all the time, is there healing from mental health issues? And I guess also, even before we go into the healing part, do you believe that mental illness is a disease? Or do you believe that it's a response to situational experiences that trigger disordered behavior?
Yeah, I think that goes back to nothing's all good or bad. I think it depends how you define disease. So if you define disease as you can take a blood test or you were born with some sort of genetic anomaly, no, I don't think it's a disease. But if you think of disease as your brain has become imbalanced, whether the behavior came first or the imbalance came first, dis-ease, as in like malaise, something not, you know, in balance, then yes. So it really depends how you define disease. I don't think it's not recoverable. I don't think that mental health disorders are necessarily permanent or not recoverable. It can be that way. If people don't get help, if they're not open to change, then yes, it might be permanent. But if someone is open to help, support, and trying something new or different, then I think it's absolutely recoverable, mental health.
I think, you know, the other struggle is there are so many different mental health professionals, right? From psychiatrists who are MDs who go to medical school to life coaches who do a certification online and start delving out advice, to social workers who work with the tasks of daily living, the struggles and tasks of daily living, and do some counseling. Then there's LMFTs, licensed marriage and family therapists, or psychotherapists, which you and I are. And our license is about dealing with the tasks, relational tasks of daily living and interpersonal relationships and intrapersonal relationships. And then there's psychologists who can do assessment and testing and counseling. And then there's pastoral counselors, and there's guidance counselors and vocational counselors. And then there's the idea between counseling, the difference between counseling someone and therapy. You know, there are so many mental health paths that and each profession has a different lens through which they look at the psyche or mental health, that I find it challenging, I think, for an individual who's struggling or suffering to even know which direction to go first. And I think that's what gets a lot of people in trouble. You know, it's an interesting statistic that the most highly medicated individuals in our society are those with the least socioeconomic resources and those with the highest socioeconomic resources. That at the best time to be of the middle class is when it comes to mental health, because those with the highest level of socioeconomic resources and education tend to go to psychiatrists right off the bat who are going to write prescriptions and don't necessarily do therapy. And those with lowest socioeconomic resources are funneled through clinics, which have the highest rate of medicating without any sort of therapy offered. So that huge spectrum of care and treatment is so broad that I'm surprised really that anyone is able to find treatment and care that is best for them.
Yeah, I think it can start with people not necessarily in the profession. I think if the general public, if we continue to have these conversations and they understand that the first thing to do is listen. You know, there's great resources online on under active listening. And if you can listen and not be afraid or try to fix something, but just sit with someone and let them cry, grieve, do whatever they need to do, and just be there with them, even if you don't have the solution, I think that's starting to show people that as a society, we can help as well, and we'll figure this out together. And I'll be your advocate. If you go to a certain professional and you don't get a good feeling, something's not sitting right in your gut, and then let's look somewhere else. But I think everyone needs an advocate, especially if they're in the depths of, you know, anxiety, depression, psychosis. They need an advocate to make sure they get a second opinion if it doesn't feel right with a certain therapist or a psychiatrist, to make sure that if they don't understand the system or what's being charged, and that, you know, they have someone that can ask those questions with them. So there's another kind of area popping up, which is health advocates. And I really think if they're well-intentioned, that those can be incredibly important, because it is a very difficult system to navigate.
I know. I think it would be nice, and the service may exist, and I'm just ignorant of it, that someone could call a number and mm-hmm. say, here are the things I'm experiencing. Here's what's going on in my life. Who is the professional that I should seek out mm-hmm. at this moment?
Yeah.
Because it might be an existential crisis or a marital problem or a communication issue or a social anxiety issue, right? Or it could be a chronic major depressive disorder.
Yeah.
But, and I don't know if our hotline does anything like that, but I think that would be incredibly useful.
Yeah. Well, I'm obviously a little biased as an LMFT, but I still feel like a therapist should be someone you can call, and by our ethical code, we have to give them at least 3 referrals that are appropriate and no charge. So I believe that that's still a good source. There's a lot of incredible therapists in SLO, and I still trust that if a client called them, they would give them some resources.
And that's important for people to understand, that unlike your hairdresser who gets hurt if you go to another hairdresser, in our profession, supposedly, if it is not a good fit, we're supposed to happily help you find.
Right.
And my concern in that, it's a whole maybe another show or the mm-hmm. same show, is that when we are dependent on our profession to pay our mortgage, my concern is that a lot of professionals don't turn people away mm-hmm. or refer them as much as they should, because they're trying to keep a full practice mm-hmm. to pay their bills. And then that goes to, are we ethically doing the work we should be doing the way we're supposed to be doing it?
Yeah, that's definitely another show. but that is a reality.
Yeah.
For sure.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest is Coraline Robinson. We're talking about mental health, the state of mental health in the world. Today is World Mental Health Day. And we invite your calls and thoughts on this subject, 805-781-3875. You are listening to Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to continue the conversation and take your calls. It's a This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you can be in contact with us by giving us a call at 805-781-3875. You can also reach me through elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can reach Coraline at Balance Treatments center of San Luis Obispo, and the number to reach Corlene is 414-8100, but it's a different area code, so it's 855-414-8100, and they're located up on Bishop Street in San Luis Obispo, and they also have a website if you want to learn more about it, balancetreatment.com, balancetreatment.com. All right, so Corlene, I started the show talking about just this sense of heavy-heartedness that I'm feeling, my friends, my family, my students, everyone around the studio, everywhere I go, it's a lot. We are being pummeled by natural disasters and personal disasters. And so what's something that the mental health field is doing right right now to help people to cope and deal with all they're experiencing?
Well, two things. I think one, a lot of, I know among my circles, both professional and personal, a lot of people are starting to talk about shared responsibility, that these disorders, these extreme behaviors, whether they're addictive or psychotic, it's a shared, it's not just in the individual. It's not just the individual is diseased.
So we're talking, maybe you're referring to the shooter in Las Vegas or just...
Not specifically. I think I'm talking more about the clients we see. When I talk with therapists, most of our clients have a story that once we understand the entire story, or as much as you know, they share with us, their behavior makes sense. It's serving a person a purpose, and it makes sense. So I think the good thing about that is that we're realizing, wow, like there's something to work with here. If we understand why they develop the behavior or the symptoms, then we can understand the need behind it and look at alternative ways. So I think that's really positive, and it's becoming mainstream to understand responsibility is shared. It's not just the individual. We've got to look at the context.
Which is a little shocking for me, and I would think for you also, because my training is in systems therapy. I mean, that's all the lens that I see the world with.
Yeah.
And this idea that everything is interconnected, that no man or woman or child is an island, that we are a product of the social world that we've grown up in, the family system we've grown up in, our community. Like, we are a product of our system. And not to make the show about the shooter in Las Vegas, but it bothers me that the comments are, he just was an average guy. There was no mental illness. He was fine. But if you read just even slightly into his history, he was raised in a family where his father was a bank robber. It's like you find connections. Like nothing happens like a cabbage patch doll coming up under the ground, that all mental health issues have their beginning somewhere.
Yeah.
And even the argument, you know, is there a chemical imbalance that causes mental health distress? I actually don't believe that's true. I believe that there's always a situational or predispositioned response to something that clicks our chemistry to go off balance. And if we can get back to the source of that switch, whether it's a family of origin trauma or a personal trauma or, you know, a relationship.
Or responding to societal trauma.
Right, responding to societal trauma, which is, I think, I guess where we are right now is that all of us in some way are responding to trauma. So what about the work with trauma? Are we now going to see an epidemic of diagnosis of depression and anxiety, thinking that we have an epidemic level of sick people? Or are we going to actually be able to recognize that all of these people streaming into offices or calling hotlines are suffering kind of a societal trauma?
I think that that is becoming more realized in the profession, more acknowledged, that you hear a lot at the county as well as a lot of private therapists and different agencies, definitely Balance included, are trauma informed. And what that means is that we understand that something did trigger these symptoms, that the behavior that was developed, again, was a response to a crazy, unhealthy situation that was not intentional or controlled by the client. It was something they actually didn't have much control over, and they were just trying to survive and respond. When I speak to my friends and colleagues, there are very few of us that have met someone who didn't have a trauma. If you listen, if you really listen. So we're not looking for trauma, but we're also acknowledging that a lot of extreme behaviors are responses to whether they're traumas in childhood or some people just what's going on in the world. It's difficult. And I think one of the great things is not only that the profession's becoming more trauma-informed, but also the resources for professionals who also get traumatized through mm-hmm. their client stories, that's becoming much more, you know, in the foreground. Like, we need to take care of those professionals, because if a professional isn't well cared for or patient, they're not going to hear all the things they need to hear to help right. that client. So I think that's becoming really mainstream. Mindfulness, I think, can also be a real positive thing, because the idea of mindfulness is that you acknowledge your thoughts and feelings, as dark and as difficult as they may be. You don't judge yourself for them, and you let them pass through. That is the healthiest thing we can do. Unfortunately, I don't think that's mainstream. I think a lot of people believe, I don't feel that, it's too extreme, I push it down, mm-hmm. I'm not afraid, I'm just going to deny. And unfortunately, that's what causes disease, both physical and mental.
Right.
That kind of denial. Mm-hmm, it pushes it down, and your body is going to compensate. If you push it down, you're going to start having a decreased immune system. There's science behind that, neuropsychoimmunology. Or you're going to start having drug and alcohol problems, because right. you have to kind of push those thoughts or feelings away. So the idea of mindfulness is, bring them. Don't judge them, but realize nothing's permanent, right. including our life, you know. So those thoughts and feelings will pass if you let them.
Well, and I think that's something that comes up so often in therapy, is the fear clients have that if I let those feelings come up, I will become overwhelmed or disorganized mm-hmm. by those thoughts, and they will own me, and I will stop being able to function. That even though I'm having to drink a bottle of wine or take a mm-hmm. sleeping pill just mm-hmm. to get through my day, now that's better than the fear I have mm-hmm. that is, if the dark thoughts come up, it will own me. And that's the biggest struggle that I have as a clinician, is helping people feel safe enough.
Yeah.
to peer into those dark feelings. Yeah. And even if they spend a period of time feeling disorganized, that in the safety of the therapeutic container, they can pull that back.
Yeah.
But I think standing on the abyss is so terrifying right. that the first response is grabbing cannabis or a bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. And the other part is that it's so socially acceptable. I mean, mm-hmm. The amount of jokes and T-shirts and bumper stickers mm-hmm. that says, all I need is wine to be fine, mm-hmm. or we have normalized mm-hmm. this coping mechanism right. of tamping down trauma and stress by drinking as just a ha-ha.
Yeah, yeah. And I do think, you know, there's still some work to be done, because I do think that's sort of an ideal situation, where as a therapist, it's easy to say, just let the feelings come in, exactly. you'll be fine. The reality is, they won't be fine if they're going to school or work or, you know, trying to pass a midterm, that you can't let those feelings overwhelm you.
No.
But if you are willing to commit to some sort of treatment where it is safe to do that, it is safe to lose control of your feelings and be completely consumed, because the therapist can bring you back. They're trained to bring you back. They're trained to keep you safe. It's incredibly hard to engage in that and actually trust that kind of relationship. But we know as professionals that if you do that really hard work up front, in the long run, you're not going to have the addictions. You're not going to have, whether it's addiction to medication, drugs and alcohol, or addiction to blaming or aggressive behavior or dysfunctional relationships, addictions.
Exercise, food,
eating. Yes. Right, imbalances.
Your cell phone. I mean, anything that numbs us from the...
Yeah, so I don't want to simplify too much, mm-hmm. but I think you know people have a choice. They can either engage in really difficult, vulnerable work in a safe environment, so usually with a professional or in treatment, or they can choose the path, if they're suffering, of denial, and the long-term effects are far worse. Far worse.
And then we can talk about mm-hmm. shifting into chronic major depressive disorder, right? That we can, the symptoms unaddressed, the feelings unrecognized or dealt with, can lead to a lifelong chronic disabling mental mm-hmm. health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I problem. Think that's where the chemical imbalances might change. Mm-hmm. If your behavior, obviously if you're drinking or doing a drug, I think most people understand your brain chemistry changes. Well, it's the same with
chronic
other
despair,
behaviors.
Yeah. Exactly.
Or chronic anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when I think about therapy, when I'm trying to describe it to people who are a little weary mm-hmm. or concerned. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my job, I see it quite often, is to be the witness to your story, and that you drag in all of the baggage that you've been, you know, dragging behind you forever mm-hmm. with your suitcases or your crates or however that big that baggage becomes. Mm-hmm. And in the safety of our relationship, you open those bags and mm-hmm. we look at them together. We sort through mm-hmm. and we repack them, because you can't get rid of the fact of trauma or loss or mm-hmm. grief. Those things did happen in your life. But with the magic of repacking,
yeah.
right, maybe sucking the air out of some of these things that really seem heavy and overwhelming, mm-hmm. we can lighten your load mm-hmm. so that you can get back to your life.
Right.
And that's how I always kind of picture it, is that it's just a repackaging, a re-understanding, and a reorganizing of our relationship with the story of our life.
Yeah, that's a great description. I think there's so much healing in sharing your story, but sharing it with someone who is not going to judge, who's not going to blame, who's not going to try and change or fix you or give you advice, but just sharing your story freely is a type of release. Mm-hmm. So it's also a physical healing. Because again, if you keep in all that cortisol, all that anger, all that shame and guilt, that is changing your gut flora, your mm-hmm. brain chemistry, all the systems that are connected. If you're able to verbalize and give words to something, there's distance. You're creating distance between your trauma and you. You're creating distance between your memories and you. And it gives you clarity, and you can't see something that's right up in your face. You need a little distance. So I think that's part of the healing, is release. Mm-hmm. Some people find release through physical activity, which I also think is incredibly healing. So it's very similar to talk, mm-hmm. to talk with someone who, again, is not so invested in you that they're going to try and change your feeling immediately mm-hmm. or fix you, or, you know, they've got to be able to be with you in that feeling.
My guest today is Coraline Robinson. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number to be part of the conversation is 805-781-3875, and we're talking about World Mental Health Day, and should we be promoting the expansion of mental health treatment, our Western style, around the world? You know, what we haven't talked about are some of the Eastern styles mm-hmm. of mental health treatment, or, you know, the success of dealing with schizophrenia in places mm-hmm. like Finland, the Netherlands, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and India. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know in one of your previous jobs, yeah. you worked with severe
yeah.
mental health issues mm-hmm. and with some success following more of an Eastern yeah. philosophy.
Yeah. I forget which country it is in Asia, but they don't have a diagnosis of schizophrenia or psychosis. It doesn't mean that they're different than us. We're all humans. They're made up the same way. But the reality is they're allowed to grieve, to release, to be a little bit psychotic mm-hmm. because it's understood that a huge trauma just went down, either, you know, in your family or in the larger context of where you live. And so this kind of response is a way of releasing the angst and the trauma and moving on. Whereas in Western culture, as soon as something is a little bit abnormal, we need to label it right away, give it, you know, a diagnosis. And unfortunately, diagnoses like schizophrenia can really stick in certain areas. So,
well, it also seems that in our Western culture, when mm-hmm. someone is abnormal, mm-hmm. given that diagnosis, we separate them from society and their family. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of other countries, when someone is struggling, mm-hmm. I mean, if you lose a child, you become psychotic. And in other countries, they absorb this mm-hmm. suffering person more mm-hmm. into the family system so that they're not alone and they feel supported until they can come back.
Yeah.
But we tend to separate people out.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing that's really important to get across is that there is still a stigma or a judgment out there that people who need support or mental health treatment are weaker. Mm-hmm. And so if that is a common assumption, then of course people would rather be seen as stronger or more resilient. So they're not going to be vulnerable and show whatever it is they're experiencing. So I think if as a society, and it's starting with Brené Brown and with a lot of, you know, people who are getting a lot of attention, vulnerability is actually courage. Vulnerability is being brave. Vulnerability is strong. So if we can show that, I think more people would be willing to break down, to share their story, and that creates such connection. I mean, who likes the person that's perfect? Right. Nobody likes that person.
Yeah, there is a natural affiliation. Yeah, there's a natural.
Exactly. That's what makes us human. You know, makes us different than reptiles or other animals, is that when someone tells us their story and their suffering, we just want to connect.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. What's on your mind? Fred, are you there? No, I think I lost him. Fred, if you're still there, hang on or call back and Bree will take care of you. So when we look at the direction of healing, therapy, mental health moving forward, as I said, you know, I still feel terrified. I don't see the change maybe that you do coming up as quickly as I think it should, because if you follow the money trail, the people who still are in power, you know, because those who are privileged and can pay cash for services can handpick the more enlightened, maybe clinicians. But for people who don't have access to extra money and have to use their employees' mental health benefits and they have to go to providers that are now, you know, under pressure from the insurance company who is under pressure from pharmaceuticals, right? It's like, I don't feel like there's been much movement towards changing how we view mental health. In some ways, I feel like we've gone further into the whole of managed care that limits people's ability to heal.
Yeah, I think I definitely see where you're coming from. I also think with the mental health parity law and everything that Obama pushed through, people low to middle income are accessing care they couldn't access before. So that's something that's good. They're actually able to get quality treatment from holistic providers who are listening to the whole story and looking at the shared responsibility. And it's very affordable because insurance companies have to legally pay for it. So that's...
But do people know that that's available to them?
I think that's another area where we need to keep educating and empowering people.
Having these conversations.
Yeah, exactly.
Fred, did we find you?
Yeah.
Hi, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
So I've developed an app that focuses on psychiatric, psychological, and digital therapy. An app that fits the aspirations and the past expertise of each patient and pulls them into artificial intelligence access to future endeavors, whether it's recreational, educational, vocational. So it's a cure-all developed with America's ingenuity from the Partnership on Artificial Intelligence to Benefit People and Society, which is made up of the major data companies. I'm the architect of that app, and we're going to introduce it here in California in the Tascadero Hospital and the local school districts and the college at Cuesta and Cal Poly to show how America has a solution for the present social problems, cultural problems, climate change, and war and peace. It's a do-all effort.
And what's the name of the app?
It's computer-aided self-help. The acronym is TASH, America's favorite subject.
Well, that is an interesting and lofty ambition. Fred, thank you for taking the time to call in. So do you, you know, it's interesting because the idea of digital therapy, the different ways we're delivering counseling are wide and varied. You know, people are doing online, Skype, sessions. And I guess those are the things that excite me, is that if we have clinicians who see things systemically, that don't pathologize patients or clients, that recognize just by the DSM's own definition that an acceptable or culturally approved response to a common stressor or loss, such as the death of a loved one, is not a mental disorder. That, again, would qualify every 90% of what people struggle with, feeling traumatized with all of the natural disasters, feeling grief after the loss of a loved one, feeling stressed about graduating from college, feeling overwhelmed with all that's happening in the world. Just by definition, most of the things that people struggle with are not a mental disorder. And so I feel hopeful that if we get enough professionals shifting their worldview, mm-hmm. the access to helping people is there with the internet and social mm-hmm. media. Mm-hmm. But I guess we'll have to save that conversation for next mm-hmm. year. Coraline Robinson, thank you for being my guest today. You're with Balance Treatment Center, mm-hmm. San Luis Obispo, and people can reach you
at 855-414-8100 or at balancetreatment.com. And we're right off of Johnson, Bishop Street.
And you serve both adolescents and adults. And
yes.
adolescents quite often go underserved more than any other population mm-hmm. Because their world can be really scary.
Yeah.
And so to put adolescents in group work like mm-hmm. you're offering, I think, is a really powerful way to help them
mm-hmm.
talk to their peers and get help. So I wish you well.
Thank
you. Continued success with that. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Previous shows are available at kcbx.org under the News Talk tab, A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can also reach me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can like our Facebook page and get updated information or leave me a message there. As always, I appreciate you supporting the show, sharing your lives, and being a part of Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back next week to continue the conversation.